Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to BiteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.biteradio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest is Paul Selig. He is author of The Book of Mastery, The Mastery Trilogy, Book 1. Most of us are searching for the path to happiness, whether we are seeking wealth, relationships, or spiritual enlightenment. Our shared endeavor to achieve fulfillment is what defines us. But how do we know if we are focusing our efforts in the right place? As a celebrated channeler, Paul Selig reveals in The Book of Mastery that we often allow our concept of happiness to eclipse the true desires of our inner self. In this first installment of the widely anticipated Mastery Trilogy, Paul imparts practical guidance from 9 benevolent guides through clairaudient dictation. These unseen intellects provide surprisingly practical, otherworldly insight to help readers achieve fulfillment and peace by setting healthy boundaries, making life-altering decisions, and embracing the challenging people they encounter on a daily basis. For more information, you can visit Paul's website, which is paulselig.com, and that's PaulSelig.com, and I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. So with that, I want to go ahead and welcome Paul to the show. Good day, Paul.
Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. I'm really anxious for you to share with the listeners the wisdom that you gained. It's quite an interesting book. So if you wouldn't mind sharing with the listeners exactly how did it start? When did you discover that you had this gift as a channel?
Well, initially I realized I had a gift as a clairaudient or the ability to hear. It really has always been a form of, I would say, telepathic communication. But I was in my early 30s, and I was doing energy work as an energy healer on the side. I was a college professor for most of my life, but I was doing this work, and I started to hear for people when I had my hands on them. So if I had my hands on your chest and I heard the name Mark, I learned to say, "Who's Mark?" And you'd say, "My father, my son, my best friend, whatever." And I gradually, through getting consistent validation from the people that I was working with about what I was hearing, began to trust it more. I'd opened up psychically a few years before that through this sort of odd experience, and the clairaudience was one of the abilities that made itself known in time.
Wow. Now, as a professor, an academic, that had to have been interesting.
Someone who's an academic, you tend to think of someone as being, very, scientifically based just very analytical, that kind of thing, and not necessarily highly intuitive, or is that just a generalization maybe?
The generalization. I mean, I have in my practice lots of people who work in the sciences who come to me for sessions, and many of them are actually pretty well developed themselves. They just don't talk about it. I was teaching in the arts, and I was schooled in the arts, so, intuition was something that I accepted, and it wasn't as far out, I think. If I had been, the chair of a biology department at a college instead of running a graduate program in writing, I think I would have had a lot harder time. But I kept it quiet for the most part. I was at NYU for 25 years on the faculty. I wasn't running a department there. And I didn't talk about it a lot. I think when I started to open up when I was younger and I was excited by it, I would reference it, but not directly. But after that, it sort of
became something that informed my life as a teacher without my calling too much direct attention to itself, because that wasn't the job that I was hired for. It wasn't my place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that, you know, it would be, my thought was that, you know, that hidden aspect, you know, or not kind of being out of the closet, so to speak, metaphysically speaking,
mm-hmm,
that,
mm-hmm.
you know, that, you know, because sometimes that, you know, people still nowadays, many, not a lot, but it's still sometimes looked at with skepticism.
Sure. I mean, and I accept that. I mean, I occasionally run across work and that somebody is doing, and I have my own impressions about the validity of what's coming through them. And, you know, and I think that that's okay. I think some skepticism is actually healthy, and I don't discourage it. You know, in my case, I was raised pretty much an atheist, and I was a bit of a hard sell. I'm not very woo-woo. I never have been. And I needed to either feel it, hear it, see it, something, you know, in order to trust it.
Yeah.
And so my experiences and my development and consequently I think the work that I do with others and my groups and even the books themselves are really about imparting a kind of phenomena or experience, would be a better word, that's real, so that people can be in their own knowing about it and not be deferring to somebody else. But, you know, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's a difference, I think, between being close-minded to something and just affirming that it doesn't exist, because if it did exist, that means everything else can't be the way that I thought it was. And also mm-hmm. some skepticism. You know, I walk into a new restaurant for the first time, you know, and I want it to be a good meal, but I don't know if it's good, and my experience of that meal will tell me whether or not I want to go back. And I think with this kind of stuff, either there's resonance and truth, or you're having an experience of it or with it that's valid for you, or it's not.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. Now, channeling, kind of, there are different ways that channeling occurs, you know, with different people. So for you, how does it work, you know, your channeling? And then, you know, in particular, in channeling the book, you know, again, this is your fourth
mm-hmm.
one.
Yeah. Well, channeling for me, which is a little bit different from sort of how I work psychically, because I also have a practice as a psychic, and I have this ability to sort of tune into people and then hear them and sort of almost become them when I tune into them. When I'm working as a channel, my guides are sort of essentially working through me. So the process for me, it's a simple one at this point. I sit in a chair, I close my eyes, I do my own version of a prayer protection, which I always use just because I think it's sort of hygienic. It's like having, you know, it's why I just believe in using that for myself. And then what I'll mm-hmm. do is I will hear one phrase, and always one phrase repeated in my mind again and again and again. It's the phrase or whatever my guides are saying really almost sort of blocks out all my other thoughts, or comes to the forefront of my consciousness. And the phrase will keep repeating, and it almost forms at my mouth. And then I give it language. I say it. And the moment I say the first phrase, the rest of the language comes tumbling out afterwards. And there's this just whole stream. And, like, they can go on for an hour nonstop. And I'm hearing things a phrase at a time. And sometimes at such a fast pace that I'm astonishing anybody can keep up with it. And that's what happens. So when I first started to hear, which was in, or channel, I would say, or work with guides, which is essentially different than my ability, say, to tune into you and see what's going on with you. When I'm working with the guides, they're directing me. And initially, I literally used to feel as if somebody had their lips pressed against my forehead, and they were sort of impressing the words into me. And I could feel the vibration of the words as they formed, and then I would form them at my own mouth. And that's one of the reasons that when I channel, which is a little odd, I whisper the words as they come and repeat them, because I became used to sort of mouthing the words in this very soft voice and then giving them full voice on the repetition so that everybody else could hear them.
Yeah. So now when you channeled for a book. I mean, mm-hmm. I can understand where you channel for messages and kind of impart that message. Yeah. So how is it different from a book? I mean, do you? Because I would think that if they're going to go like a mile a minute,
minute. They're going to go. It's the same thing. If I'm channeling if I'm channeling at a workshop, or I'm channeling on a live stream, the process is the same. I just sort of recede, and then the language comes forward and carries itself and carries me along with it. The process with the books is interesting because I don't know what the books are about. I mean, I've had a sense sometimes only because of what they've been teaching through me for a few months. Then I hear there's another book, so I assume it's going to be some of that stuff because that they seem to prepare by lecturing through me to groups, and then when the time for the book comes, they just deliver it. But the books are, and this is without exception, and there's four of them now, they're the unedited transcripts of channeling sessions. So there's no writing involved. These books are all spoken by my guides, chapter after chapter after chapter. Sometimes they'll do a whole chapter in a sitting, sometimes a quarter, sometimes a half. I never know. They'll go anywhere, usually from half an hour to, they've been known to go an hour and a half at a time, which is about the limit for me. And that is then transcribed, and that is the book. But they'll say chapter one, chapter two, chapter three. So the first book, I Am the Word, took 2.5 weeks of dictation. The only things that were edited were occasionally the guides would say to Victoria Nelson, this wonderful friend and writer who's on the phone in Berkeley, California. I'm in New York, and she's listening to this as it's being delivered because I can't just do it in a vacuum. There has to be somebody there to be hearing that keeps me on course. Or sometimes I'll do a chapter now or a portion of a chapter before a group, say, in a live stream. That happened in the last book. So there were 200 people present when some of the dictations were happening. They're now in print in the text. But, I don't remember what I was saying. I just deliver it. It's just delivered through me as it comes. And Victoria would ask in the first book, sometimes the guides would say, do you have any questions? And she would say, ask about something personal. And we decided that that wasn't appropriate for the book because it was about her personal life. And that was it. For the edits, nothing else gets changed. I may mispronounce or a word. I think it happens maybe 3 or 4 times in a book, or they're using a word that I don't really know, like effulgence or something, and I look it up afterwards, or Victoria will say, no, I heard it, and this is what they said, not effuence, it's a real word, and then we go there. But that's the process until it's done, and then it's typed up, and, God bless Mitch Horowitz, who's the editor that I work with at Tarcher Penguin, who's been very, very clear about leaving the teachings intact and not messing with them and not, prettifying them, for the reader. I think if I were working with somebody else, they might have said, well, you need to elaborate here, cut this down. And these books are really just a straight dictation.
Yeah. Well, I kind of sensed that once, I was reading because, the language that's used in the phrasing, sometimes it's very wordy. there was probably an easier way or a quicker way of saying that. Like, for example, at one point they were talking about the choice, that we have the ability to choose, and there was an example of a guy who threw a penny down, one picked up the penny, and in that, it talked about that, it is not true that we're not accountable for the choices that we make that impact others. So, it was in some cases like that, and with some channeled messages, it takes, me to go back a couple times to get it. It's like, oh, they're saying that it's true that, we are accountable, of thing.
I don't know. I've never read A Course in Miracles. I tried when I was in my early 30s and thought it was very beautiful and probably very true and very dense, and I didn't get through it, and I think it probably wasn't appropriate for me to, and that my own work would come or the guides that I work with would be delivering their own teachings in time. So I've never I think very highly of the integrity of that teaching.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah,
but
and I agree.
The guys that come through me are also working with language, and, you know, they're working through a body that's not theirs, and they're appropriating a vocabulary for the most part that's mine because that's what they have to work with. And it's also a verbal transcription. So there are things that I would say if I were to go back and edit my answers, even in this conversation, I'm sure I could distill it. And I think they do a pretty good job about actually keeping it simple. But I do know that their language is their language as they use it. The sentence structures, how they phrase, it's what it is. Mm-hmm. It's channeled.
Yeah, I agree. Now, the guides, mm-hmm. you know, I mentioned in the introduction, you know, that there are nine benevolent beings. Can you talk a little bit about who they are from what you've been able to discern who they are?
I didn't know there were nine until they said there were nine of them there that day. So maybe it's on your side that this has come from. I'm hearing all these people saying Paul's channeling nine benevolent beings. I'm going, where does that come from? In fact, I hear pretty much one voice, sometimes specifically two. The texture is different, but the language is very consistent. And there's a point in the book where I was kind of ready to give up because I was having a really difficult time interpreting the message that was coming. I was just resisting the teaching. That's really what was happening. And I think somewhere in there they said, listen, like there's nine of us here today trying to work with you to bring this teaching through. Now, my experience with them and what I have seen, I don't see nine beings fill up the room. When I was working, I was seeing orbs of light show up, which were quite beautiful. But for me, it's a very physical experience. I'm somewhat of a physical medium, so my body takes on other mannerisms. When I'm doing groups before people, it's very common at this point for my eyes to change color when I'm channeling. They often run a very bright blue, and I have hazel eyes, you know, and I don't wear contacts, you know. So, you know, the guides that work through me are teachers, and that's how they've described themselves consistently. They've said that they are operating at a level of consciousness that they call the Christ consciousness, and they've used names at times, but only publicly recently. And in the new book, they do use the name Melchizedek, as if you want to call us something, you can call us that. But I'm happiest with the guides, and the reason I call them the guides, and they've never objected to that really, is that my ex used to say, ask the guides this, ask the guides that, when my ex wanted to know, you know, what he should do about something.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's my, you know, understanding that, you know, there's this particular group, you know, that the you know, whenever channelings happen, sometimes there are more and less depending on the message that need to be delivered.
That sounds right, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, with the, I think there was one point in the book that they said something about to address them as I am word. Is that correct? Or
no, they said Melchizedek.
Okay.
You know, used the term word as well, which is logos. So at times they've said we are word. You know, we are at that, which I understand to mean at that level of consciousness. But their definition of the word, which is specific to them, is the energy of the creator in action. So when they say we are word, I think they're identifying at that level. But they would also say that that's who you are and who everybody else is when they're aligned to their own truth. You know, we think we're a small self, we think we're a personality, and their message consistently has been that we're vastly more than we think we are.
Yeah, okay. Now, one of the things that they also indicated is that this is not a self-help book, or they don't write self-help books.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because it seems like, you know, there's some practical advice to help you.
I think there's a lot of practical advice to help, but I think, you know, I don't know if they're the ones who said it first, or I think they do say it maybe in an earlier book. They say in an earlier book we don't write self-help books. They don't believe in them. But I think the reason for that is that self-help books are for the small self, They're for the personality structure. So how to get rich in 20 days or how to lose 50 pounds in 3 weeks or whatever. And what the guides are doing is something very different. I think that they're addressing the true self. They're speaking towards the realization of our own divine potential. So fixing through the small self, which means I'm going to fix it through my own willpower and become a better person, whatever that means, that's the small self's idea of what a better person is, as ascribed by cultural history about what better and good means, you know. The guide's teaching is very different than this. It really is that each of us is an aspect of the divine in manifestation, seeking that level of realization as who and what we are in a manifested self. That's the teaching of the Book of Mastery, and in a way, all of the books, but they're really pushing us, I think, towards a level of concretized knowing of who and what we are as our true selves. So self-help books, they would say, I think, is for the small self. And that's not who they're writing to.
Yeah. Now, in the book, there is, you know, in addition to small self, but there's there's reference to the divine self, to true self. And so what's the difference? I mean, you know, you gave a little bit of a description of the small self, but the divine self in true self, are they one in the same, or are they different?
Yeah, it's the same. It's the same. They use different language, I think, to this is my sense, that they use different language to support those of us who are coming to a teaching with very different vocabulary. I mean, they speak of the Christ in their books, and people go, oh my God, it's a Christian book, and I don't know that that's necessarily true. Their definition of the Christ is the aspect of the Creator that can be realized in material form, and their teaching is a beautiful teaching, and it really is about, you know, the divine self or the true self being the inheritor of the kingdom. And the kingdom, as the guides teach it, is the awareness of the Creator in all manifestation. But, you know, they're taking it to a level of universality. So if you don't come, because I think when they're speaking of Christ, they're not necessarily speaking of Jesus, although they honor that teaching clearly in extraordinary ways. And I think they're speaking to the innate divinity, which they would call the Christ or the true self or the divine self or the Shekinah or the divine spark. My sense is there's probably a name for it in every spiritual discipline, the Buddha self, the realization of that as who we truly are. That's always been their teaching.
Yeah. Now, it was interesting often in the book when they were referring to divine self, you know, even talking about your aspect of the aspect of your divine self as she, you know, in the, you know, and I was wondering if that was, you know, and that, you know, obviously that is not really gender specific, but to me it was just very interesting because in all of the channeled readings and all of the books I've ever read, you know, it's not often given that feminine, that I guess the divine feminine in a way.
Yeah, they didn't used to do it. I know that in the first book. In the very first book, Victoria Nelson, I think, complained to them. I don't remember whether this was in the book or in a private session. I think it was actually in I Am the Word. I think they did address it, and because they were saying mankind and when man realizes. And I think they took the note, truthfully. I really do. I think that they took the note. And they're quite agile with pronouns at this point. But they'll actually, I mean, what's weird to me is sometimes they'll switch them in the same sentence. You know, the realization of man's awareness of her own divinity. You know, and what they're saying, what they're meaning by man is human or humankind. So they're kind of getting rid of genders entirely. And I think they use it in such a fluid way because, again, it's inclusive to all.
Yeah. I found it because I would say probably in the beginning of the book is when I really noticed a lot. But then, of course, also toward the end of the book, there, you know, there was also a he, you know, referring
yeah.
to it. So, I mean, it was obviously, like you say, fluid. But
uh-huh.
I just thought it was interesting. So
it is interesting, yeah. It's what they do.
Okay. Now, one of the things that, you know, it seems that those clients and readers, you know,
mm-hmm.
say that they have an experience of a shift when reading the book. And
yeah.
in the book, it talks about, you know, basically just the essence of the teaching and the words and going through, you know, the lessons, so to speak, that this
mm-hmm.
transformation happens. So can you talk
mm-hmm.
a little bit about that, why you think that
yeah.
that is so?
Well, you know, the books themselves, according to the guides, and this is true for all of them, are energy transmissions that work directly on the reader and on the reader's consciousness and field. So it's not uncommon, if you go back and you look at the reviews for I Am the Word or, you know, many of the books, you know, you'll hear people saying, I'm reading the book and my body's vibrating, I'm reading the book, I'm having this, you know, a psychic experience, whatever. People are opening up. And they're opening up in strangely enough, in ways that are often somewhat dramatic with these encounters. And I know this because I meet these people. They show up at workshops and, you know, they're having their own experiences. And I think that that's great. But the guides say the books are operating on two levels. They're words on the page, which are the provide an intellectual context
mm-hmm.
for what you're reading. But the real book is what's informing your energy field. And so that's true whenever they work. So if people come to the live streams, the guides are working with energetic attunements, and they use this with language. So there's language that supports people in a realignment of the energy field to align them to their higher potential. The simplest way to understand it is the guides often say we're all radios. That's who we really are, and what they're doing is tuning the radio or the vehicle that we are to be able to play a higher broadcast. The broadcast is always present. It's our birthright to play it, you know, and to be at that level of awareness, but they have to sort of shift our own sense of what's possible, and they do that, again, through energetic attunements that come through language, and the books are made up of language and vibration.
Yeah. You know, also there's quite often in the book, there's phrases for people to use.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't necessarily say, if you said it repeatedly, it would be like a mantra, you know, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
do you think that those suggested phraseology also may contribute to the shift that people experience?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's just what I was saying. It's the language
yeah.
that they're using. So the guides don't like the word mantras that much. They don't use it often. They do
right.
use. They do say that these things are claims of truth,
okay.
and that they're claimed by the divine self. And the divine self knows that they're true. So when the guides say something like, "I know who I am. I know what I am. I know how I serve," my personality is going, "I don't know who I am, and I don't know what I am, and I don't know how I serve." But the true self, the truth of who each one of us is, the guides would say, knows this truth. So when you're claiming this, you're claiming it as the divine self. I know who I am. I know what I am. I know how I serve. And this will actually correlate to a level of vibration or attunement that will support you in your own awareness. It will shift the field that you hold and your consciousness. So there are many of them in the book. And I think they would say that they're all claims of truth. That's just the simplest
okay.
way to say it.
Okay, great. Yeah, because I know I hesitated to use the word mantra because I
right.
had a feeling that wasn't really, you know, exactly what they were trying to get at. But you know, words of truth. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the book, the title is The Book of Mastery. So,
mm-hmm.
what is it that is being mastered?
Well, that's a really good question, and let me see if I can even answer that. What's being mastered, I guess, is a level of realization about who one is outside of who one has taught to be or believed oneself to be or agreed to be at a lower level of consciousness. So the small self operates in fear or can go into agreement with fear, the guides would say that the master self or the divine self doesn't, because she or he doesn't exist at that level of vibration. They're also speaking very directly to mastery as the ability to transform the material realm, which is really kind of trippy for me, and I'm still wrapping my head around it, but it's where they're going in their teachings. They're saying, essentially, how each one of us perceives our world is giving this world form, and how we imprint the world with our own beliefs about what things are, the names we give things, concretizes that form. As we realize who we are and we lift our vision to a higher level of truth, and they would say that the divine is present in all things, regardless of what it looks like to us or what our opinions might be about us, about it, as we realize that, we actually lift the material realm or the landscape that we exist in to that level of energetic agreement or accord, which is a word they use a lot. So the master, I'm going to ask them, so I may have to go into, if I channel here, just so you know, I'm whispering the words and repeating, that's just how it comes to master. The guys are saying the master is the true self as you, the manifest itself, the manifest itself, who knows who and what she is, who knows who and what she is, does not deny her truth, and does not deny her truth. Each one of you is this, in fact, each one of you is this, in fact, as you claim what you are, as you claim what you are, in manifestation, the denial of your own truth. The denial of your own truth is always the source of your unhappiness. It is always the source of your unhappiness. The belief that you have, the belief that you have, that you cannot be this, that you cannot be this, is what you pretend to be, is what you pretend to be. We have come to teach you other. We have come to teach you other. And they're saying other, period. And they're saying period. So that's the answer from them.
Okay. Well, you know, it's, I thought it was, interesting during in the first part of the book, they talk about how, really what we perceive is not real, and that that we are living in an agreed upon reality, so to speak, or agreed upon circumstance that's created by all of the individual consciousnesses combined.
Yeah, that's what they say, and it was interesting to me. They talk, as the books go on, they're talking more and more about collective structures or collective agreements. And, all of this stuff of you create your own reality, I get it at a level. I'm not going to disagree with it. It's a big sort of New Age teaching. But I think the guides are also saying that we're also in agreement about many things. Now, for example, did I create the war? No, I didn't create the war. However, because I can perceive the war, because I see it, I have a relationship to it. Because I have a relationship to it, I have an energetic accord with it, which means I'm in response or accord with it. How I choose to be in response or accord with it actually transforms the thing that we would call a war. As we all transform our relationship to this, the manifested thing then changes as well. Now, here's a simple example of this. Because the guides say we're always perpetuating our history. They say you've lived on a planet with war for so long, you can't imagine living without one. You can't imagine a planet without war, and consequently, you're going to keep claiming war because you expect to have it. This is a collective agreement. So we all complain about the banks, but we put our money in it. And the guide said, you can complain about the banks, but you've created the banks, and you're affirming the banks every time you put your money in it. I'm not telling it. This, just don't ever think that I'm telling you to take their money out of the bank.
Right.
It's an illustration. But it really is about how we concretize a reality and give things meaning. And the guides are really, I just did a whole workshop in Toronto that ended yesterday, and they did this whole lecture that I was just, I don't remember the gist. I remember the gist, but I don't remember any of the details because I actually had somebody holding my ears so that I couldn't hear it as it was coming through me because I knew I was going to have resistance to it. But they're really talking about how naming anything is giving a tremendous power. And that once you take the name away from something that it's had, it can begin to move to another form. Because essentially how we name things or how we claim things in manifestation solidifies their form.
Yeah, and I can understand that. You know, and it's interesting that, you know, because I can understand that. I mean, if we have, if we're in this, you know, conscious, created reality that we have here, that shared reality, then, you know, to shift it to something that's, I mean, and we're all entrenched in it, you know, in what we do, what we say, you know, all of the, like all of the institute, everything that we do and be really is supporting that, you know, and it seems that the only way then to make a shift is on an individual level, kind of, you know, get a better hold of that divine self and then who we are, and then maybe create a ripple effect in the greater, you know, quantum consciousness that we have.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. Now, one of the things that that they speak of, the guys speak of, is the idea of a coming revolution in consciousness. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I'm real curious about that.
Well, I mean, I suspect what they mean here is that we're waking up, and that the waking up is not always extremely graceful. I mean, they've said many times that we're at a time of reckoning. And they call a reckoning a facing of oneself and one's own creations, which essentially means if we made it, it's ours. And if we made it, we have the opportunity to recreate it in a higher way. If we made it, we don't have to be a victim of it. Because we made it, we can actually recreate it because it's been made once, it can be made again. So the revolution in consciousness, let me just ask them, because, you know, that's not a term that I use, and I suppose there's a reason you have it as a question. Let me ask them what a revolution is. What a revolution is a rejection of what was, and that is what's happening now, and that is what is happening now. Mankind is rejecting what it's known. Mankind is rejecting what it has known and believed in and believed, or to claim a higher form, in order to claim a higher form. What you have worked with, what you have worked with is failing you, is failing you. You're killing your earth. You are killing your through your intentions to give yourselves what you need, to give yourselves what you need. You are killing one another. You are killing one another in vast quantities in order to protect what you think you have, in order to protect what you think you have, and you are no longer aligning. And you are no longer aligning to what you were taught, as true, because the truth has failed you, because the truth has failed you as you were taught it, Consequently, you are claiming a transition. You are claiming into manifestation a higher form, a new way of being and regarding oneself, and one's fellows. This is the beginning of great change. It will be here for some time. Period. And I'm saying period. That's your answer. I've never heard that one before. That was interesting.
Okay. Well, you know, it's, they talk about this path to mastery isn't necessarily an easy one. I mean, it's something that we have to work at. And they also talk about it's important to be, you know, can you talk a little bit about being and doing, and because it seems
sure,
like,
I agree
with both. So,
well, you know, I mean, it is a teaching of being. It's not a teaching of fixing things. It's not a teaching of rushing someplace. The guides, I think, would say how you be as your true self is what claims a whole other life to you. It's your consciousness in manifestation as you. So how you be at this level of engagement with your own divine worth, the right that you have to claim this and then the manifestation of it, transforms the landscape that you live in. So here's a simple thing. If I think I'm a piece of crap, and some days I do, and I'm not happy and I'm cranky, my world reflects that. I live in a world that reminds me of who I am saying I am. As long as we continue to say that we're separate from everybody else, that we're operating on a billion little islands that have to arm themselves against whoever's on the next island, we're going to be playing in a field of separation, which my guides say isn't even true. They say you can't be separate from the divine or from God or whatever you want to call it. It's impossible. They say it's in everything. We believe ourselves to be separate, and we're not. The being of the self at that level is that level of realization. Now, the doing comes from the being, and that's a different way of looking at action. When the guides say, I know who I am, they're saying, I know who I am as a divine being. I know what I am in this manifestation, in this body, in this life, in this physical form that I've chosen to be in. How I serve, the claim, I know how I serve, means how I or you or any of us is most fully realized and expressed as the divine self. And that's action, and that may be well implying action that will be called to you through the divine self, not through figuring it out what you're supposed to do, which is always the small self relying on historical data. Well, my dad wanted me to be a lawyer. I guess I should be a lawyer, but I really want to be a painter. And so maybe I'll be a painter, but then I won't have any money because everybody says artists don't make any money. And here you go. This is all about what people have thought before you and you're agreeing to. When you stop agreeing to who you think you are and were told you are, you can begin to claim who you really are. And that's the truth of who everybody is. And at that level of expression, it's about being, and then the doing is the consequence of the being.
Okay. Okay, that now, you know, to me it seems that one of the practical applications of aligning with the divine self is in cases, let's say, for example, I'm on a tarmac in Toronto and things aren't going right, you know, and, you know, that rather than get upset and that kind of thing is to just to recognize that it is what it is and maybe just be in the present moment and not kind of, you know, go on to, you know, all kinds of, you know, not so pleasant thoughts?
Well, I think you can go there if you want to with it. And I think the guides might say, yes, I'm the crankiest guy on the tarmac you ever want to meet. You know, I upgraded myself on the flight home yesterday, which I don't always get to do, but I was really tired. I channeled all weekend, and I was so happy to be in my first class seat. And then the guy next to me was snoring loudly, and the people right behind me were talking so loudly. I was a cranky guy. But, you know, this is what happens when you try to predict what your life should look like, and it's not.
Okay.
Now,
okay.
I did, and I will say this on my own behalf, I didn't go into reaction. I did go into my own claim. I know who I am. I know what I am. I know how I serve, which actually reminds me. And, you know, and then I watched a movie with the earplugs on and nobody bugged me at all. I was perfectly, perfectly fine. So, but is this about not feeling our feelings? No, I don't think it's that. And I think that, you know, there are times when it's okay to be cranky, and my example wasn't a very good one, but there are times when it's also okay to feel fear or anger or whatever. I don't think it's about pretending that we're not human. I think
right.
what the guides would say is it's about not aligning to those things and going into agreement with them and then creating from them. It's not about being reactive, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, and I understand. And see, and I read that on your Facebook post. So, I mean, you know, that was one of the, to me, you know, the idea of putting on earplugs and, you know, and there was one point in the book that talked about reframing oneself, you know, and it seems like, you know, that is, you know, when, I mean, it doesn't change the feelings or, you know, it's not denying, you know, the feelings that one has, but it's simply reframing it into a different perspective, you know, that, you know, makes it less stressful. I mean, you know, on a physical realm, less stressful, you know, less irritating, you know, basically easier to work with.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm not going to disagree with any of that. I mean, I think that, you know, I don't think I would be doing, I didn't get into this work, you know, or the idea of having a spiritual life because things were going so terribly well. I was deeply unhappy, and this is how the solution appeared. And really through, in my case, I started praying for the first time in my life when I was 25 years old, and then everything began to change very, very rapidly. It was a very quick and dramatic opening for me. So I don't think this is about feeling badly. I just want to say, I think I was just trying to say, it's not about dishonoring our humanity. Claiming our divinity, I think, isn't about pretending that we don't have feelings and all of those things. I think we do, and it's part of the amazing experience of being here.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there was one point in the book they talked about, you know, and I even mentioned it, that really the goal should not necessarily be happiness, you know. I mean, that the goal should be more of alignment. And am I reading that correctly?
I think that's pretty good. I think happiness may be the byproduct of alignment. But, you know, for me, this is the quandary with happiness. My idea of happy is a really good movie on Netflix and a big box of Oreos, you know, which is, in my case, I mistake happiness for comfort and complacency, and the last thing I need to be eating right now is a whole box of Oreos, you know. I'd be better off taking a walk in the park than watching the movie on Netflix. I'm not going to knock any of it, you know, it's all fine. But I think they're speaking about something else. They're speaking about a level of awareness, and they speak about joy. So happiness, I think, you know, happiness can be taking a pill so I don't have to feel my feelings. You know, this may be something very different that they're working with us on. And sometimes I think that actually involves confronting some of the things. Actually, I know it does because it's so much of a teaching of a new book, confronting those things that we've given so much authority to. That makes us unhappy, you know.
Yeah. And one of the things they talk about too often is not acting on fear. You know that the fear is
the consistent teaching.
You know, do you think? I mean, because if we look at today's environment, fear is thrown out so often. It's almost, you know, if we're thinking about a greater, you know, collective consciousness, you know, that we experience, you know, looking at the amount of fear baiting that's going on, it's, to me, I don't see how we can make that shift when we're fed it so often.
Well, just because you're fed something doesn't mean you have to eat it. You know, we have choice here.
Right.
We have great choice here. I live in New York City, and I was here during 9/11, and I was here after it. And we were all being told, I guess the rest of the country probably was as well, but we'd all just been through something. I mean, I live downtown, you know, and it was horrific. We were all told that, you know, on one day we'd have a red alert, and the next day the orange alert, and the next day the yellow alert. and everybody was always primed for fear. And what happened in the city, as I recall it, is we finally got sick of the alerts, and people just started going about their business again. And the alerts went away. You know what I mean? We just went, okay, there's another alert. I'm still going to go have a life. But we stopped giving power to the fear, and consequently, we stopped being in agreement with it and stopped being manipulated by it. So the guides say, that I work with again and again and again, they say that the action of fear is to claim more fear. So if I'm going to be frightened, I'm going to be asked to make choices based in fear. And if you look at your own life, look at every choice you've ever made because you were afraid and see what it got you, you know, and probably more fear. I mean, my guides say there's not a lie that's ever been told that hasn't been told in fear. Not one. Even the white lies are based in fear, you know. So that's what they say.
Wow. And one other area that they talk a lot about, too, is service. You know, that's one area that I think that we can really give more attention to. What is the opinion, you know, that they provide about that?
Well, when they use that claim, I know how I serve. As I said earlier, that is the true self expressing itself in fullness. And truthfully, to be in your alignment, the guides would say, is service in and of itself. You can't help but impact the world because how you're seeing your world and how you're in your world is in a very different way. So they say one person wakes up to who they are and 1,000 more wake up, you know, as a result. We're all working in energetic accord. So, you know, the problem we have around service, I think, is we've again ascribed through history what it's supposed to look like. And how you're to be of service is how whatever it takes for you to be most fully realized as you. That's what you give back. That's what you give back to the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, gosh, we're down toward the end of the show. Before I ask if there's any messages from your guides, I do want to let people know that you do also you have a workshop going on this weekend, correct?
Do I this weekend?
I think I've got something
in New York City on Thursday this coming
week, at the center
in New York. And I'm this weekend I don't. I think it's my one weekend off. But I know that I've got one coming up in Los Angeles at the end of the month on the 30th and the 31st in Topanga Canyon, which is right outside of L.A. And I've got workshops all over the country coming up. So that's all on my website, which is paulselig.com.
Great, great. Okay. Now, any final messages, maybe from your guides or from you, that you may want to give to the listeners that we haven't already covered?
I'll go. We want to say one thing. They're saying we want to say one thing. Stop fighting yourself. Stop fighting yourselves. You think you're supposed to fight yourselves. You think you're supposed to fight yourselves. When have you ever won the war with yourself? When have you ever won the war with yourself? Stop fighting yourselves. Stop fighting yourselves. You'll stop fighting the neighbors. You'll stop fighting the neighbors. Stop fighting the neighbors. Stop fighting the neighbors. You'll stop fighting the ones on the other side of the border. You'll stop fighting the ones on the other side of the borders and the other side of the continent and the other side of the continent. And the world, and the world. You understand this? Do you understand this? You choose these things. You choose these things. You can choose them differently. You can choose them differently if you say yes to the possibility of it. If you say yes to the possibility of it, thank you for your presence. And they're saying to you, thank you for your presence, period. And they're saying, period. That's how they sign off.
Great. Well, Paul, thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it. I really enjoyed our talk, enjoyed reading your book. And,
thank you. Thank you.
And do want to let everyone know that you are on Facebook. They can follow you there and also check out all about you on your website. So I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Okay, bye now. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Paul Selig. We've been talking about his book, the new book called The Book of Mastery, The Mastery Trilogy, Book 1. And again, you can find out more about Paul by visiting his website, which is paulselig.com. And again, I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again... Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's BITERADIO.ME. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.